In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books and Science, Technology and Society, a podcast for the New Books Network. I'm your host, Chad Vlasic. Today, we'll be talking to Nicholas Bauck about his book, A Geography of Digestion, Biotechnology and the Kellogg Cereal Enterprise. This book touches upon a history of the Battle Creek Sanitarium and John Kellogg, specifically Kellogg's connection with the digestive system to material processes and assemblages, such as the urban sewer infrastructure, agricultural production, and the food production within the sanitarium itself. So let's go ahead and welcome Nick to our show. Welcome, Nicholas.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Chad.
Great. So I was wondering if we could begin by you just telling us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. Well, my professional background is in geography. I discovered geography in my undergraduate days at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and ended up majoring in geography, and in some ways kind of never looked back. I took a break from school and academia for a while, but then returned to get a master's degree in geography, at which point I got in, which marked the beginning of my interest in food studies. At that time, I was really interested in some of the legal naming of foods, and particularly in the European Union, where they have these geographical place indicators. So I got really interested in some of the legal history of that geographical naming of foods. And then for my graduate school for my PhD, I went to UCLA, which at the time at least had a heavily weighted humanistic and cultural and historical geography department. Which is what I was interested in doing. I've always kind of been drawn to historical geography and cultural geographic theory as it applies to space and environment and landscape. So at UCLA, I continued that interest in food studies, but got sort of came across this, what I conceived of as sort of a gap in the way people were talking about fluid geography, and both in terms of production, which it was really heavily influenced by like political economy discussions and political ecology, like how landscapes are made by economies and food growing landscapes, but then also within consumption, food consumption studies, there were really focused on sort of cultural attributes of why and how people eat what they do in certain places, and in neither of those conversations were people explicitly talking about digestion or the process of digestion. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Now, maybe there's something I could say about digestion and as a fundamental part of eating, and how that relates to kind of a food studies or a food geography discussion. So that's how I got into the digestion thing, and then kind of fell backwards while I was writing my doing my graduate work and writing my dissertation, kind of fell backwards into the Kellogg story, in part because John Kellogg, who was the person who ran the company in its early years, at least, was so kind of, he was obsessed with a lot of things, but he was obsessed, one of the things he was obsessed with was digestion, and he wrote a lot about it. So it was a good way to start really thinking about, like, how does digestion work for this person in this time, or how did he think of it? How did he incorporate it into his medical practice, and then eventually into his food production regime? And sort of the geographical twist then is how do you situate that time contextual story into place? What is the place of where this was happening, which is Battle Creek, Michigan, and the kind of upper Midwest and Michigan landscapes? How did those play into the way Kellogg was able to practice his health philosophy of kind of digestive reductionism, and how did it make the growth of this type of eating, eating cereal in particular, breakfast cereal, that is now ubiquitous in many parts of the world? So that's a little bit of my background as it relates to this project. I can tell you more about my background if you want. I'll let you kind of chip in though, Chad.
Yeah. So I think we could just go ahead and move into the book itself, if that's all right with you. So why don't we start actually with talking about John Kellogg's background here, because the first chapter on the Battle Creek Sanitarium deals a lot with his family and religious background, and into his medical training and eventually heading the sanitarium. So could you tell us a bit about his trajectory there?
Yeah, definitely. So it's important for readers to know that as a case study, the book is centered on the character of John Kellogg, who is one of two brothers, the Kellogg brothers, who kind of ran this cereal business for its first 50 years, basically. They started, so John Kellogg was a doctor, and he grew up in Michigan and became a doctor. And as he was becoming a doctor, this path toward medicine, this would have been the 1870s when he was doing this, so quite early in terms of like formal medical schools, and in terms of the sort of increasing access to things like bacteriology and scientific discourse within in medicine. He was kind of in the earlier edges of that in medical schools. And he, the whole time he was doing this, it was kind of, it was wedded with this relationship he had with the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which had just itself come into being in the 1860s as a new Protestant denomination that was based on millennialism. So in other words, a impending end of the universe was coming soon. And there was this theology of preparing oneself and one's body for that impending end of the world. So that's kind of, that's where he came from in terms of like kind of his intellectual milieu. And essentially what happened and what I talk about in this chapter is how that that science background kind of was played out in the context of his religious upbringing and his religious benefactors, really importantly. So the Battle Creek Sanitarium, this the place of health that I talk a lot about in this book, was started and funded and founded by this new religious organization, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, essentially as a one as a architectural manifestation of their theology and their health philosophies. Health philosophies being things like take really good care of your body, don't eat meat, don't drink caffeine, tobacco. They were like kind of these like for various reasons were seemingly ahead of their time. In the way we talk about how to be healthy now, they were saying this, you know, in the 1860s and 70s, and yeah, so they and then two, the reason for the Battle Creek Sanitarium was that it was their kind of business model. It's how they stayed afloat as a new organization. They got people to come and stay at the retreat slash clinic slash hospital slash resort in this kind of idyllic woodsy Michigan setting, and people came from all over, mostly the East Coast, to kind of take a break, pay them some money, go through this health regimen to get, make their bodies clean and healthy and ready to go back to the urban rat race. So Kellogg was appointed sort of the director in starting in 1876, was appointed director of this sanitarium and took on, he took it on completely. He just kind of threw himself into it and did advertising, promoting, did his own kinds of research, some of which were really wacky. If people know the story of John Kellogg, they know a lot of what he did was really strange. He had like electric beds and light baths and these abdominal punching machines and all these things that we kind of look at now and say that that's like, I don't know if I need to do that to be to like have a healthy body.
Yeah, that, that you mentioned like in the book too, The Road to Wellville, the movie, and that's how I am familiar with this story at all. I used to watch that. I don't know why my parents let me, but they, I would just watch that movie kind of over and over again.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I like, and it was interesting in reading that book and watching the movie again for this, when I was doing the research for this book, it was interesting to know like that, you know, it's this like, you know, imagined fiction, but definitely based in a lot, some reality. Like they're going to take their creative license with making that, that story. But a lot of the things that we find absurd were in fact definitely documentable things that, that Kellogg, did, like the kind of,
Yeah, the machines in particular. Yeah.
Yeah, and they have them. It's interesting. They have them on display at the Battle Creek Heritage Center. You can go look at these. They're very mechanical. They're trying to be very cutting edge. A lot of them are like electricity based, which then was, of course, a really big deal. They're trying to like, it's this kind of new Gidget Gazmo, like for better health thing that was going on. So there's some of that. There's a lot of, conservative, I guess we would say, like health advice, like very conservative sexual health advice, striking even by today's standards. But one of the things that Kellogg was persistent about throughout his published career, at least, the things that he wrote about consistently was this concern with digestion. So I'm kind of in that first chapter to get back to your question. That's what I'm trying to do, is set this up as like, who's this character who had such an influence? Where did he come from? What were his intellectual precedents? Who were the people he was surrounding himself with? So in the first chapter, you'll see, like some of the debates that went on between the spiritual leaders of the church and appointing a director of their sanitarium wellness center place. There's like these, some conflicts that ensued about how that should be operated. And Kellogg kind of found himself in the diplomatic center of enough of those conversations that he kind of emerged as the person to whom they granted the keys to the place, and he kept them until his death in the 1930s, I think. He was director until the 1930s, at least. That's a little bit of the background for the first chapter. I think key there is probably, or another key there, I should say, is I get really interested in the geographical notion of place and as it applies to the sanitarium and its grounds themselves. So, you know, there's a lineage of historical geographical writing about how place functions, how place acts as like a bundler, basically, of different social and environmental attributes that make this unique thing. The point of which in this book is that for people to experience Kellogg's brand of healing, they had to like get on a train and go to Michigan, to go to Battle Creek. Like you had to be in the building, like with the architecture of the building, did things that allowed his brand of healing to happen, and not least, and also including things like the slope of the hill and the soil around. At least this is how they talked about it, right? So they were very into that notion of selling the place as much as they were selling an idea, which I think is really interesting from an introductory first chapter sort of, hey, this is like an interesting geographical story. Here's why.
And so who are they trying to get out there? Could you talk a little bit about the people that trekked out there to the sanitarium?
Yeah, so these were middle upper class, again, mostly people coming from the East Coast, urban areas, but also a large group of, you know, a large constituency would have been from Chicago. It was white middle upper class, mostly moneyed, oftentimes famous. They had there's a list of famous people, but people like the Rockefellers, Fords, people like that would come here. Presidents would come and get their picture taken or stay for a couple nights. So it was this kind of elitist, prestige-y thing to do. Like, I can take a week off. I can go to Battle Creek and stay, be diagnosed by this person who claims to have insights on how the body functions in certain ways that are going to make me feel more energized or more capable of doing my work better. And it's just interesting, even just saying that, it's interesting to put in the context of how we talk about our relationship to like a capitalist economy today, where, you know, it's like there's all kinds of programs like that. You know, I'm thinking like Esalen in Northern California, for example. It's like this like super special retreat kind of yoga place where you go and cure your body and mind and get ready to like re-enter as a new person back into this society that one cannot take on its own. So I think Kellogg was really, you know, he was performing that role as well at this time in the late 19th century of a kind of, hey, need a break, come out here and chill out for a while.
Right. And didn't he also have like a eugenics conference there too?
Certainly. Yeah. He would have in later years. That probably would have been in the 19 teens. He got really into eugenics. But when you read kind of the time periodization of the book, just for clarity for listeners, is mostly 1860s through 1900 or so. But when you read this, because the idea of the book is that it's kind of the backstory of the emergence of the corporation. So the Kellogg Cereal Corporation is something that happened I think it was incorporated in 1913. So Kellogg is known to history as a eugenicist also, and should be held to critical account for that as well. It makes sense when you read the backstory how he might have arrived at that, at hosting a eugenics conference or doing lots of writing about it or whatever he did. He was just obsessed with the application of science to anything, as many people in that time period were. So it was, if you could like scientize it, he wanted to be a part of it. And if it had to do with humans and human bodies, he wanted to be a part of it. And so I think that comes out in the book of like, oh, here's this like character you see doing this as it pertains to digestion. And it's not like a hard logical leap in the retrospect of history, like looking at this person in his time and place to say that he like would have gotten into that stuff.
Right. Yeah. Which you talk a bit about in the first and second chapter. So in the second chapter, he's particularly taken by germ theory and how this relates to digestion. So could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So the second chapter it's a more kind of deeper dive into the type of science he was using and adopting to sell to his patients and to keep his benefactors happy and all that. He learned about germ theory in medical school in New York and at the Bellevue Hospital and then at the University of Michigan in his medical school. And he got really into it. It comes up early and frequently in his writings about the stomach and about digestion. Most notably, there's an 1896 book called The Stomach that he wrote And in that book, he kind of outlines his look to the French bacteriologist, Charles Bouchard, who had this theory of that was called auto-intoxication. And so Bouchard was observing or trying to make the case, at least, that when bacteria sit in the body without movement, it creates poison or toxins in the body. And so while not untrue in the strictest sense, as we understand it today, Bouchard and then Kellogg, by sort of adoption, took that to a really logical extreme. And Kellogg applied it to eating and moving through food through the body. So he was like, he was, his message, Kellogg's message, at least in 1896, was food should never stop in your body. Like, we have to eat to stay alive, and that's this like unfortunate fact, but I'm going to try to make it so that the food never stops, so that putrefaction and toxicity never happen, therefore, in your body, and therefore all these like ailments will be cured, as far as things like headaches and backaches and you know, hysteria, like you name it. It was related to how cleanly and efficiently and quickly and how sterile food could be in and move through the digestive system. Yeah, so it's really that Bouchard auto intoxication thing that kicked off it set a program for Kellogg. It set a 15 to 20 year like plan of action for him, where he was trying to figure out the exact right foods that would move the best through the body.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. So in this chapter, you also talk about some of the measurements that he did, and in terms of how he wanted to get this zero bacteria number that somehow he reported, and how that relates to, you know, this idea of deviance that you also talk about. Mm-hmm. So, in relation to that, what were some of the measurement techniques that he used, and could you talk a little bit about how, like, it seems like the patients were actually pretty excited to get these reports, and how that led to a very specific kind of diet for them that they often,
right. It was like,
they often went against that because apparently there's a sub economy that you also talk about where they can go and get some meat.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I think it's part of the attraction and the salesmanship and salesmanship in a like partly in a huckster sort of way, but partly in a like genuinely, this is what we have to offer you. This is, we think we're doing something interesting sort of way. Part of that message was that like, hey, if you come here and hang out with us at our sanitarium and pay us this fee, like we're going to give you an objective. We have a way of giving you an objective answer of what your body's doing. And then we can know exactly how to fix it. That's a pretty interesting thing in medicine in the 1890s, to make that promise. People would arrive and say, this is again, like mid 1890s, they would get off the train, they would go into the sanitarium examination room, and they would have, they would be examined by John Kellogg, at least the first time. He had like a whole staff of nurses and stuff. They fed the new patients a very specific like test meal. Usually, and this would have been like it's grain based stuff. So they gave them like crackers and breads and maybe some fruits and things like that, like dried fruits. And then they would have the patient come back, like usually later the same day, and they actually inserted a tube down the patient's throat and pumped out the partially digested food, and then measured it for things like acidity, how quickly it was digesting, how much proteins were remaining or carbohydrates were remaining in the test thing that they gave them. They could do this all numerically and compare what they knew the or what they thought at least the food started with to what it was as it was partially digested. And they could say like, okay, well after a few hours, after let's say 3 exactly hours, you've digested 36% of our test meal, and there's this high of a hydrochloric acid level, and therefore, you know, we deem you. He had all these words like you're either hyperpeptic, hypopeptic, anapeptic, respectively, meaning too much acid, not enough acid, or just totally something totally going wrong. And there were a number of other categories. And they charted these out. They had limits like, okay, between 5 and 8% is hypopeptic, between 62 and 68%, or this level of whatever they're measuring for, is this sort of problem. And so this is the deviation, right? You're literally seeing, you're actually seeing in these charts the lines being drawn and color, and they color coded them into different types of people. Like you are this kind of sick person based on where you fall in this chart. You're that kind of sick person based on where you fall in this chart. And that was, I think it's frightening, and yet we do that today with all kinds of things like BMI, body mass index. I know like Julie Guthman's written a lot about that. But I think about, so how prevalent and freaky that is today, but how comforting that might have actually been in the 19th century. To say, oh, like this is okay. This is like this. It's like this identity thing, and of course, then it's also completely it's creating these bodies, right? It's creating this ideal body type and reinforcing what it should be, and then I mean. Exporting that vision of what a body should be to at a national scale, when you think about why cereal, how cereal plays into it, and the impetus for designing cereal the way they did, it was to get all the bodies into the right square on the chart, or into the right cell in the chart. So people would then, they would take the results of this test meal and pump their stomach with this tube and take it to the lab, do the measurements, and then prescribe, as if it was like a medicine, they would prescribe what people should eat for the remainder of their stay at the sanitarium. And it, again, usually was very grain-based, nuts, fruits, things like that, vegetables, in varying doses and quantities. And people would inevitably, get sick of eating all this like boring, bland food. And there were all these kind of incognito places in town that would serve steaks and cigars and things like that. So it's kind of a funny side story that there was this like sub economy of not gross food.
Yeah. So thinking about the cereal in particular, of course, the third chapter is about this sort of serendipitous events that led to not one, but at least two contradictory stories about the invention. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how, the cereal was invented, how these different stories came about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think when you say stories, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sort of interpreting that as that there was kind of a conflict in the creation story.
Right. Between William and John.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So these two Kellogg brothers who kind of ran the company for its first 50 years, they didn't have a great relationship. For people who know some of the story will already know that fact. So a lot of the sort of different storytelling around the invention of flaked cereal ended up having to do a lot with intellectual property, like who had the rights to this product that was all of a sudden by the 1920s and 30s being exported all over the world and sold as it's an extremely popular mass-produced, mass-marketed food product. So a lot of the kind of secondary histories or the storytellings of what happened, and even going back to the primary documents, like the court case testimonies and things like that, they're just kind of riddled in uncertainty of exactly what happened. But in the book, I try to kind of triangulate between secondary histories and the some of the primary documents and it's not the most important thing for this book on how it actually happened. So I just try to do my best to give kind of the important details of the story. And the important details of the story are that at one point, it's a story of John Kellogg trying to figure out how to make food, how to engineer foods, quite literally, how to design and engineer foods so that they could do his, so that they could not get trapped in this auto intoxication thing, so that they could move through the body really quickly. And he was just having a hard time doing that without the stomach creating what he thought was like too much acid or too much bile or too much or leaving too much sugars as byproduct that would go into the bloodstream. Like, he didn't want any of that stuff, really. Through his way of doing these tests, he was experimenting with different ways of baking breads and grains, and a lot of that story kind of stems from the backstory of granola, which is a whole other thing that I talk about a little bit in the book. But eventually they leave out this like sheet of mashed wheat and it dries out and they send it, they bake it and then crack it, and it turns into what to us would look something like cornflakes. They were made with wheat, importantly enough, at the time. But it's this process of you take wheat, you mix it with water, you make this doughy kind of thing, and you flatten it out through kind of like, again, what we might think of as like pasta rollers that they appropriated from another kitchen use that they were using them for. And now off the top of my head, I can't remember what that was. But they essentially took these steel rollers, like 2 foot long steel rollers, and rolled this mush through them to create the thinness, this thin layer that could be dried out and then kind of cracked like with a hammer after baking it again into flakes. And there was something about like the property of the flake itself that performed the way that Kellogg wanted it to in his chemical lab analyses. It left the right amount of sugar. It tended to help people not make as much stomach acid when they digested. And so he thought this is great for him. It was the miracle food, right? It was the thing he was looking for. It put everyone in the right cell in his chart. Or it put enough people, at the very least, it was a thing that he could talk about and sell. So that's the controversy. The different stories are basically like, well, who left out the wheat? Who put it through the rollers? Who mashed it? Who broke the chunks off with a hammer? and so for me, I don't really care about that for this book, but I do want to represent it as accurately as possible, and in part because it's also important to the cultural history of the Seventh-day Adventist church. So, I want to at least do respect to that.
Yeah, and then in this chapter, you also talk about the role of John's wife, Ella, specifically in the kitchen. And you also make this connection here between, place and making of cuisine, cuisine versus kitchen, some of these important differences. So could you talk a little bit about Ella's role and as well as like the role of the kitchen in terms of Kellogg's sanitarium and science?
Yeah, absolutely. So they ran an experiment kitchen, which is where a lot of this, including the cornflakes story that I just told, which is where a lot of that happened. At some point in, it was, I want to say 1893, John Kellogg's wife, Ella, became the director of that experiment kitchen. So she got really, she bought in to what John Kellogg was trying to do. She was a huge supporter. But she kind of took her own way too, with the running of the kitchen itself. So she would, it was this very hierarchical thing with John Kellogg at the top. So he would say like, we need this thing to happen. And then she would like try to figure out how to, bake, he'd say like, we need wheat mixed with corn baked for 3 days or something like really ridiculous, and add a little bit of like tomatoes to it or something like, and then that'll be our bread snack for the patients tomorrow. And then she would like figure out how to make that all happen. Yes, but she was really into this notion of the making of a cuisine, which is what they were doing essentially. They were making their own cuisine as a very place rooted thing, and not to say like, oh, this is happening in Michigan. In terms of what I mean, instead is this is a place rooted thing in terms of it has to happen in this kitchen. Like, I'm going to set up this kitchen such that the types of things that we need to make are easier to make. Like we have to have a certain kind of oven that gets to a certain temperature. We have to have like baking trays. We have to have like places to roll out doughs and places to dry fruits and vegetables and places to blend beans and things like that. This whole like implementation is it's the geographical sort of moment of doing a cuisine. It's not just like people here eat this kind of in this country eat this kind of food. It's like it's more like the Italian cucina, or a number of languages have this, where the German, Portuguese, where the word for cuisine is the same word for kitchen. And so I was just kind of making that observation in the book that it's misleading in a way in English that we have this separate words for those two things. You know, one derived from Latin, one derived from German, kitchen and cuisine. It's interesting that we make that distinction so predominantly in English, because it kind of hides the fact that you need the geographical place-based kitchen component in order to realize the cuisine.
Absolutely. So the kitchen and the tools within it are part of this extended digestive system landscape, as you put it. So thinking about that, another sort of system or object here was the development of the sewer systems, which Kellogg played some role in. So what was his role in this, and why was it so important for him and his sanitarium?
Yeah, and it kind of gets into you know, the core of the book too, just to flag for listeners too, that the geography of digestion here is really making the argument that John Kellogg's version of digestion could not have happened without these very material, very spatial connections to other technologies and landscapes in southern Michigan at the time. And so as you said, the sewer system of the town is a really important part of Kellogg being able to practice a sterile digestion. You know, he was in charge of the sanitarium when the city of Battle Creek went from outhouses and privies to a centralized water carriage sewer system. And it's not uncommon that that would happen in this time period in the United States. But what is really striking is that while he was sort of refiguring what he called the modern stomach at his sanitarium, he was also for a decade served on the board of the Michigan State Board of Health as a member, and got really involved in the design and implementation of the sewer system in towns throughout Michigan. Including, of course, in Battle Creek. So he, you know, he never put it this way that I saw in any of the writings that he did. But he was, by his actions and by his practice, actually performing this kind of urban infrastructure, the making of the underground urban landscape of Battle Creek as an extension of what he was doing to the more visceral, more fleshy tubes inside of people's bodies. He was kind of connecting those two tube systems in a way, if you want to think about it like really graphically or visually. One being iron, and the other being flesh, inside flesh, inside people's digestive systems. And again, that was, it all made sense to him, and it, there is a logic to it when you get into his rationale, at least, that it's like, well, if we want to stop, if we want to stop stagnation, in other words, if you want food to keep moving through the body, then we should also stop stagnation like the human waste privies and outhouses. That should have a flow to it as well. And indeed, It's like it's interesting and fun to kind of imagine, like, okay, so he was actually connecting, like, his philosophy was going from bodies to the Kalamazoo River to Lake Michigan to the St. Lawrence Seaway to the Atlantic Ocean. You know, he was like kind of doing that flow, whether he wrote about it that way or not.
Yeah, that's really interesting that he has this already this extensive landscape that, you know, now we're talking about, but then certainly, you know, as far as I know, no one else was talking about it in that way. So the other part of it too, being the nearby agriculture that he also had a role in, that affected the sanitarium and this landscape of digestion. So what was so important about the changes to agriculture at this time, and how did it relate to Kellogg?
So and this is, you're pointing toward kind of the fifth and last main chapter of the book, which, yes, is about the agricultural hinterlands in southern Michigan that supplied the what became to be the mass amounts of wheat and then eventually corn that supplied all of their health food products, not least cereal, of course. So the agriculture part, again, and it's the book, if you've kind of been following along, you may have noticed that there's this kind of scalar transect. Like, you start the conversation of the book very much in the stomach and the scientific health philosophy, and then you go out to the food lab, and then you go out again to the city, and now we're going out the furthest amount to the farthest distance. We're going out to like the farmlands and as far away as maybe other states and things like that. So we're really bringing the digestive system out away from its human body, at least. So the agriculture thing, it's interesting for a couple reasons. One was the introduction of, or the intensification of, mechanical agriculture, mechanized agriculture, was a huge part of that was a discourse at the time among farmers and among city and state governments and agriculture experiment stations, and people were really interested in how do you apply these notions of increased efficient soil utility or soil fertility. How do you, you know, get the most out of your soils? How can you manage more and more acres? And it all taps into the globalizing. It's part of the conversation of the globalizing economy of agriculture, where you were on this a scholar named Michael Goodman called the technological treadmill, and talked about that in terms of agriculture, where you just have to keep applying more and more inputs to fields to make them grow more and more, in this case, wheat and corn. So Kellogg's connection to that is the simple observation that, A, they were a huge consumer of these grains, and so we're benefiting from cheap and easy access to mass market their food products. And B, they were connected in a very sort of poetic geographical sense, in that two of the major manufacturers of large-scale mechanized agricultural implements, Advanced Thresher Company and Nichols and Shepherd Farm Machinery Company, were both based in Battle Creek. So down the road from the health sanitarium, you had the wrought iron factories that were pumping out thousands of threshers and combines and harvesting machines that were exported all over the country, really, but mostly the Midwest, but all over the country, so that farmers could kind of take part in their or participate in this what we now know as the death of the family farm and the rise of industrial agriculture. So the health food was a reaction against sort of a local organic farm, and Kellogg wanted to replace that ecology and that ecosystem with this large scale, sterile type of agriculture that promised, at least for him, and the promise that he made was that that food was better for you, basically. And I think that's a really interesting point that I kind of came across in doing this research, is that our sort of national consciousness reaction against industrial agriculture these days is that we should react against it and do something different, which I believe we should. But it comes from sort of the same spirit that Kellogg was coming from, in that spirit is there's something terribly wrong with our food system and we need to do something different. You know, Kellogg was saying that, and he went towards industrial agriculture. We're saying that now, going against industrial agriculture. So it's just like a neat kind of historical reminder to just be careful of like the precedent for your kind of rationale or the way you're thinking about food systems.
Yeah, in the epilogue, you say something along the lines of biodiversity of the gut is a political move. So I was wondering if you could speak on that and really just how, you know, besides what you just spoke about, how this story relates to today's ideas around health and food production and things like this.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So the politics of the book, and I tend just my style and my personality is that I'm not heavy-handed with the politics, but there is a strong politics to the book, really, which is that we should not think of human health as something confined to the body inside the skin as we know it. Human health is always inextricably entwined with the landscapes that surround us that we look at, and we can use those landscapes, in fact, to read the health of human bodies. And that's what I'm trying to do really in this book, is give a little like methodological practice for how we might actually do that. Well, how do you read into someone's body by looking at a landscape? And that's really, even though the Kellogg story is the case study, the sort of methodological practice move is to do exactly that. And to me, that's the political move too, is that like, hey, let's pay attention when we have conversations about public health and or individual health, like people like with cancer, like let's talk about on a large scale or over a population scale, at least let's talk about the landscapes where people live first, or in addition to the like individual cancerous body, because they have to be tied together.
Well, Nicholas, we've taken up a lot of your time, so I just wanted to wrap up with our traditional last question here. What project are you working on now? What's next for you?
Yeah, great question. So after I wrote this book, I actually did a whole other project that was very different, that was based in the American Desert Southwest. It's a project about the visual history of the Grand Canyon, actually, in Arizona. And that project is also finished. It's called Enchanting the Desert. But what I'm working on now is related very much to that Southwest desert theme. I'm doing some work with some historical documents in the Mojave Desert in Southern California, the desert between Los Angeles and Las Vegas.
That's where I'm from.
No way. Great.
Yeah.
We'll have to talk about that then. Doing some, again, looking at some historical documents from the USGS about that region. But interestingly enough, I'm really interested in something that came up in the Geography of Digestion book. Was this notion of how do you translate these concepts in geography and in STS and in history of science, like network, like landscape, like space. And there are many theorizations of how these things work. And one of the things over the past 5 or 6 years that I've really noticed and gotten really into is what are the visual articulations of some of those ideas? So often they appear in textual form. I'm really interested in how you take something like this concept of network, specifically as it's applied in geographical theory building, and visualize it with the aim of then further strengthening the way we're using our spatial metaphors, things like spatial metaphor being something like network. But there's also other metaphors like hybridity or verticality. There's lots of things floating around, again, like geography, STS, environmental humanities. There's a lot of these spatial metaphors that are going unvisually examined. And so actually this fall I'm beginning, I'm retooling, actually. I'm going back to school and beginning a Master of Fine Arts program at the University of Minnesota, where I'll be exploring exactly those themes and making some visualizations based on the geographic theory that I know and like so much.
Well, that sounds really interesting. I wish you the best of luck with that.
Thank you. This has been great to talk with you, Chad.
Absolutely. So yeah, we've been talking to Nicholas Bouch about A Geography of Digestion, Biotechnology in the Kellogg Cereal Enterprise by UC Press. Thank you for being on the show today, Nicholas.
Thank you. Really a pleasure.
I really enjoyed it. Take care.